I'll find out and let you know. Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Emily, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequests of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Religion, Terror, and Error, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Challenge of Spiritual Engagement. Today's guest is Dr. Johnston, whose visit is arranged by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy for the World Affairs Spring Lecture Series. There are lecture brochures in the back of the room. Dr. Johnston has served in senior positions in the public and private sectors, including 5 years at Harvard University, where he taught international affairs and founded the executive program in national and international security. His most recent assignment was as executive vice president and COO of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Dr. Johnston is a distinguished graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and holds an MPA and a PhD in political science from Harvard University. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Johnston.
I always feel guilty getting applause before the product. Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be with you today, and I thank our hosts for sponsoring this opportunity. I noticed on my BlackBerry coming over here that the Pew Research has just come up with the figure that some 74% of the world's population is suffering from a lack of religious freedom because of religious hostilities that are taking place there. This is some 5 billion people all told, which is quite a lot. When you think about it, how, you know, penetrating these religious imperatives have been on the geopolitical landscape, it seems tremendously ironic that the United States, which is one of the more religious countries on the face of the planet, has such difficulty dealing with these kinds of issues. As has been very apparent from our involvements in Iraq and Afghanistan, we have very little ability to deal with religious differences in a hostile setting. We have no ability to counter demagogues like bin Laden or, for him, Milosevic, who manipulate religion for their own purposes. And there are a number of reasons for that, but several that stand out are our long-held commitment to separation of church and state, which we've used as an excuse for not doing our homework to understand how religion informs the worldviews and political aspirations of others. It's not a matter of we should get rid of separation of church and state. It's a matter of that does not excuse us from doing that kind of homework. Secondly, has been our commitment to the rational actor model of decision-making, which has governed our practice of international relations for as long as I can remember. And this is a model from which non-rational factors like religion are excluded. So we simply don't know how to deal with it. It's not on the policymaker screen. Hasn't been. And then finally, I think are the political ambiguities surrounding our separation of church and state that inhibit our political leaders and military leaders from addressing the religious dimensions of the threats that they are dealing with. And so we're out there effectively with one hand tied behind our back. Well, when you marry these realities with this looming specter of religious extremism married to weapons of mass destruction, it just makes all the more urgent this need to fill this gap. And one approach that has shown unusual promise is a new form of engagement called faith-based diplomacy. Now, what is that? Well, at the macro level, it simply means including religious considerations, into the practice of international politics. At the micro level, it means actually making religion part of the solution. And if you want to go deeper in it, there's a book that we put out just a couple of years ago called Religion, Terror, and Error. And the subtitle is U.S. Foreign Policy and the Challenge of Spiritual Engagement, as Emily mentioned at the outset. And it's really a kind of a how-to book. It's how to incorporate religious considerations into the practice of U.S. foreign policy. So those kinds of issues get treated in the daily course of business. And we're a long way from that at this point, although there's some progress being made. And it's, excuse me a second. It's also how to get beyond the rational actor model that I was talking about to a process that accommodates both non-state actors and non-rational factors like religion. And then finally, it's how the United States can move toward a new paradigm, leadership paradigm, that will serve us better in the multipolar world that awaits. And if I had to give that a bumper sticker characterization, I would say it's servant leadership at the international level, where you lead more by example than by force. Easily said, more difficult to do, but I think we may be slowly moving in that direction. At least that's my hope. Well, since our center's inception, I established this International Center for Religion and Diplomacy August 1st of 1999. And since then, we have been involved in a number of places around the world practicing this faith-based diplomacy. And we started in the north of Sudan, then to Kashmir, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, right now as we speak, the United States itself. The list goes on. But I just thought I would cite two examples to kind of illustrate how this faith-based diplomacy works so you get a feel for it. First, when we started out in Sudan, there were any number of NGOs. An NGO, by the way, is a non-governmental organization, which is what we are, nonprofit, basically. There were any number of NGOs working in Sudan, but they were all working in the south, and they were trying to relieve the suffering that was taking place as a result of the conflict, and I think doing about as good a job as one could do. We took a different tack. We went to the north, and we deliberately set out to establish relationships of trust with the Islamic regime, and from that vantage point, try to inspire them to take steps toward peace that they wouldn't otherwise take. We were about a year and a half into that process when we had a meeting of religious leaders and scholars about the religious dimensions of the conflict, of the civil war that was raging between the Islamic North and the Christian and African traditionalist South. And by the way, you hear a lot about the Christians in Sudan, but they're really only 5% of the total population, so it's not a huge number. There were 30 people involved. 10 were Muslim, significant Muslim, Sudanese Muslim leaders, and 10 significant Christian Sudanese leaders, and then 10 internationals from both faith communities. And the most difficult challenge there was getting the Christians to participate, because over the course of the previous 10 years, the government of Sudan had sponsored 3 international interfaith conferences at which the Sudanese Christians were not ever allowed to voice their grievances. Whenever they tried to, they were deliberately drowned out. So they thought this was just going to be one more PR gimmick for the government. And very spirited discussions ended with them actually deciding to come for 2 reasons. One, I told them, I said, you know, there will be no PR. And I said, and secondly, you have to come whether you want to or not. So this is about making peace. And you're Christians, you're supposed to be peacemakers. So whether you want to or not, you have to come. Well, they did. And with their heels dragging, but after the first day, they came up to me with smiles on their faces and said, "You know, this is the first time we have ever been heard." And then by the third day, this thing lasted about 3.5 days, you had high-level Muslims around the table who were actively voicing the need to address some of the problems they were hearing about. Well, when it was all over, there was a genuine breakthrough in communications between the two sides. And there were 17 consensus recommendations that emerged. And I'll mention one of those in a minute. But one must ask the question, why was this successful when the wounds ran so deep? And I think it was because it was an exercise in faith-based diplomacy. Because we began every day with readings from the Bible and the Quran. We proceeded every day with a prayer breakfast for the internationals at the hotel they were staying at, and for local religious leaders on a rotating basis. But more to the point, we brought a prayer team from Santa Barbara, California, halfway around the world, whose sole purpose was to pray and fast during those 4 days, praying for the success of the deliberations. So while all this was going on, you could see these folks coming in quietly from the side, listening to what was going on, figuring out what needed to be prayed for, and going out and praying. And they were matched by a like number of Sudanese Pentecostals. When my vice president called with the idea of doing that, he asked me what I thought. I said, "I think it's a marvelous idea." I said, "I can't imagine that people who pray 5 times daily are going to get upset if we bring a prayer team." And they didn't. So that was, you know, that had an impact. And I think that it caused people to rise above themselves. And they got really down and dirty about the issues, but it was all done in a cordial tone of voice on both sides. So it was really pretty remarkable. At the end of it, one gent who was retired from the Foreign Service made 2 observations. He said, "This is the first time in my limited experience." Now, his experience must have been, you know, limited only by the fact he was only 80 years old instead of older. But he said it was the first time in the history that he knew of where Northerners and Southerners had talked to one another, spoken to one another from the heart. And then secondly, he said, you know, in his experience, he had never seen such a single concentration of intellectual horsepower as existed in that meeting on the Muslim side. And that wasn't by accident. That was by design. Because we weren't there to overthrow the regime. We were not there to abolish Sharia law. We were there to answer one simple question. Is what steps can an Islamic regime take to alleviate the second-class status of non-Muslims in a Sharia context? And if we could get some good answers to that by highly credible Muslim figures, then this could resonate in other parts of the world like Nigeria and Indonesia, where the same kinds of struggles were taking place. So it one other element of the faith-based diplomacy in that situation was the fact that when I would have conversations, for example, with the foreign minister of Sudan, and these would be realpolitik kinds of discussions in which we're trying to persuade them that what we were suggesting they do was in their own best interest to do, but looking for convenient spots to make a helpful reference to the Quran or how the Prophet might have dealt with it or what Jesus would have to say about it. And whenever I do that with anybody, any Muslim I've ever dealt with, they open up. Because this is what they like to think they're about, integrating their religion and their politics, which is quite different than the norm that most of us are used to. So that's just one example. Another example I'd like to give you is was our work in Pakistan. Now, we've spent 7 years on the ground reforming the madrasas, the religious schools that gave birth to the Taliban, among other things. And just to give you a little backdrop, very few people in the West are aware of the fact of the illustrious history of these schools. Back in the Middle Ages through the 16th century, they were without peer as institutions of higher learning in the world at the time, absolute peaks of learning excellence. And then later, under the impact of British colonialism and fearful of losing their Muslim identity, they purged themselves of all subjects that were deemed to either be Western or secular in nature, to the point where vast majority today are about the rote memorization of the Quran and the study of Islamic principles. And so one thing you would be amazed at is to learn is how many of the traditions and mores of academe that you're experiencing right now trace their roots back to the madrasas. The mortar boards and tassels you wear at graduation comes from the madrasas. Funding a chair in a given discipline comes from the madrasas. And I could go on and on. The point is, and it shouldn't be a terrible surprise, because that was the model a long time ago. Our goals there have been twofold. One is to expand the curriculums to include the physical and social sciences, but with a very strong emphasis on human rights, particularly women's rights, and religious tolerance. Secondly, and possibly more important, is to create critical thinking skills among the students. We're born with it here in the West, but in these tradition-bound tribal cultures, there's not a whole lot of room for it. And what you have is you'll have these students, youngsters, who have memorized the Quran. They don't have a clue what it means, by the way. They're memorizing at a very young age. It's in Arabic. Their language is Urdu, so they're pretty clueless as to what it's all about. But if you memorize it from cover to cover, you get a title in front of your name, Hafiz, which means good things for you and your family in the next life. But along comes this local militant to recruit these kids to his cause, and they have no ability to question or challenge. They just do as they're asked to do or told to do. So that's why it's very important. Now, over those 7 years, we engaged some 2,700 madrasa leaders from 1,600 different madrasas. Sounds like a lot. It's not. There's 20,000 madrasas. But all the ones that we addressed were in the most radical areas, and we feel very confident that this thing will take the country by storm. Now, let me tell you why we've succeeded where nobody else had, particularly the government of Pakistan. We did it in such a way that the madrasa leaders felt like it was their reform project and not something imposed from the outside, which means they had a lot of ownership in the change process, and they would come up with great ideas. Secondly, is inspiring them with their own heritage, not only the heritage of their schools, which I mentioned, but going back earlier in Islam to the early days, when many of the pioneering breakthroughs in the arts and sciences took place under Islam, including religious tolerance at a time when Christianity was woefully intolerant. Okay? And the more they hear this, the taller they walk as they internalize it and they say, hey, maybe we can do better too. And then finally, two more. One, I think, is probably most important, is we've grounded all suggested change in Islamic principles so that they can genuinely feel they're becoming better Muslims in the process. And they are. And finally, one we don't talk about much, but whenever I do, it sort of blows their minds, but we have operated from a posture of total humility, driven by our awareness that was in the United States was very complicit in planting the seeds of jihad in the madrasas in the first place. We were trying to grow holy warriors to evict the godless Soviets out of Afghanistan. So the Soviets left, then we left, we come back. They're doing what we trained them to do. They've just changed targets. You know? So this gets you to the law of unintended consequences, which our country subscribes to far too often. But that's the reality of it. And just to bring this alive for you a little bit, I'll share just a couple of anecdotes with you. At one point, and this is probably 7 years ago, I took a couple of our board members over, and we visited three madrasas that were clearly identified with terrorism. First one was outside of Karachi. It was a Deobandi madrasa. There's five sects that sponsor these religious schools. By far the most powerful and influential, far more than the other four put together, are the Deobandis. That's where the Taliban came out of. So we walk into this room. It's about this size, actually, and it's full of tough, seasoned Islamic scholars and madrasa leaders and what have you, and the room was full of rage. Rage over U.S. foreign policy, and also at that particular moment in time, Israel was locked in combat with Hezbollah in Lebanon. And whatever Israel gets does, we get credit for. So to get past the rage, I said a couple of things. I said, we're not a government organization. I said, nor have we had any funding from our government. I said, and while the United States may have made some mistakes of late, it's important for you to remember where we intervened on behalf of Muslims in Bosnia, Kosovo, Somalia, Kuwait. And I said, left untold in most recitations of Somalia are the more than 100,000 Somali lives that were saved as a result of the humanitarian aspects of that intervention. I said, furthermore, while you can fairly criticize the United States of operating with a double standard in the Middle East because of our strategic relationship with Israel, I said, so too do the Arab leaders operate the same way. They complain mightily of Israeli mistreatment, but then turn a deaf ear to Palestinian pleas for humanitarian assistance. So I say, everywhere you look, there's double standards driven by perceived national self-interest. So this was kind of to break past the rage. Then what I did was I shared with them three passages from the Quran that I had committed to memory, a consolidated paraphrase of which goes as follows, and I'm sure some of you have heard this before, but it says, O mankind, God could have made you one had he willed, but he didn't. He made us into separate nations and tribes that we may know one another, cooperate with one another, and compete with one another in good works. I said, I and my two colleagues are here to open the competition in good works. And I said, three of us happen to be followers of Jesus. And I said, we know you cannot be a good Muslim unless you believe some pretty wonderful things about Jesus, which happens to be true. I can go into at length at that if you'd like. So I said, let's ask ourselves, how would he want us to behave toward one another if he were in our midst? Well, over the course of the next hour of conversation that segued into a social gathering, the rage had been converted into a spirit of total acceptance, bordering on fellowship. It was really remarkable to behold. We then went to a madrasa outside of Lahore that was identified with the London bombers. Same routine, same result. And one of the things interesting about it is the gentleman who was the head of that madrasa was a large, widely revered and somewhat feared individual, but three times since he has happened to cross paths with our project director, who's a Pakistani American, who's absolutely fabulous and deserves the lion's share of the credit for our success. And each time he's mentioned the question about Jesus, and he says, it's caused me to ask myself on a daily basis, what would the Prophet have me do? So this madrasa that had been, involved in the terrorism business was now sponsoring seminars on peacemaking and conflict resolution, and that's without having had the benefit of our workshops. I mean, it was just that one visit. So you never quite know, how that seed is going to grow when you plant them out there, but it was very encouraging. So another vignette I'll share with you. This, what this is really about is, rather than dealing with the guns, so-called, bombs and bullets have their place, but rather than dealing with the guns, we try to deal with the ideas behind the guns, okay? And this is a good example of that. Some of you may recall that the Taliban at one point took over something called the Swat Valley, which is sort of up in the mountains. It's something of a resort area in Pakistan. and heads were rolling all over the place. And we had a workshop for 16 madrasas surrounding the valley. And toward the end of the workshop, one gentleman stood up. Turns out he was he's a madrasa leader, but he also was a terrorist commander. He was in Lashkar-e-Taiba, the terrorist group that brought the attacks on Mumbai, among others. And he stood up and he said, you know, he says, I came here for one reason and one reason only. And that is to discredit everything you have to say. He said, but now I find myself standing here full of rage. Rage because for 26 years I have studied and taught the Quran the way it was taught to me. He says, in this workshop, he says, I feel it for the first time in my life, I've sensed the soul of the Holy Quran and its peaceful intent. He said, I now know that understand that the right way to advance Islam is through peace and not through conflict. He said, I'm going to change what I teach my students and I'm going to tell them why. Well, it was pretty bold for someone to say that in an area in that kind of a context where people's heads were rolling. And maybe he got cut some slack because he was a terrorist commander. But we came back a month later and happened to have a CNN team with us. They'd been after us for 3 years to document our work. And we took him in, and he said it on CNN for God and the entire world to hear. I mean, it was just amazing. And I think he realized he was getting on thin ice because he said enough at that point, you know. So he knew he'd probably overstepped his bounds. But anyway, what that illustrates is that once you can get past the veneer of hostility and rage and engage these folks, not only do they get it, but many of them become personal champions of what you're talking about at great personal risk to themselves. And that's just been mind-boggling to me and very gratifying. And that's how our numbers actually grew significantly, was engaging the unusually gifted ones, making them master trainers, and they would go train others. So that's kind of, you know, that's a illustration. And systemically, we've done some things as well. We took the National Madrasa Oversight Board, which is not a government entity, but these are five religious leaders that sit on top of the five sects that sponsor these schools. We took them to Turkey and to Egypt to see how Islamic education is handled in those countries. And they went with a bit of an attitude, thinking, you know, what can these secularists teach us religious purists? But they came back very humbled because they found that students in both of those countries not only could handle religious questions every bit as capably as any Pakistani madrasa student, but they could also handle contemporary problems because they'd had the training in the other subject areas, the science, the math, the computers, what have you. So now what we've done is we've engaged about seven different universities in Pakistan who are providing training for madrasa faculty. One of the things that body decided when they got back was from then on, they were going to require certification of all madrasa faculty. Before then, there were no standards. You want to open a madrasa, you just open the madrasa. And as you can imagine, the agendas varied widely. But that took place and is still going on. We reached a point where I sat down with our project director one day and I said, from this day forward, I don't ever want to mention our center's name in Pakistan again. I said, we're too widely known and we're too targeted. And I couldn't believe the timing, but 3 days later, out comes a 7-page online jihadist journal article that goes to all the cells in Pakistan and Afghanistan, specifically targeting our work. And so our indigenous partners over there, who had been incredibly brave and courageous in getting us into the most difficult areas, they actually fled the country when that article came out. And they're back now and doing what they do, but it was so threatening. Fortunately, 2 years earlier, we'd put in place the legal framework for an indigenous NGO that we would one day staff up and pass the baton to, because our job is always to work ourselves out of a job by building capacity, not dependency. So having that in place, went ahead and staffed it up, took our project director, let him go, made him president of that indigenous NGO, and He and his wife moved to Dubai. It's too dangerous for them to live in Pakistan, but he's only an hour away. And we got the State Department to put up $500,000 to support the project work that that indigenous NGO is now doing, and it just got renewed the other day for another $600,000. Because finally, you know, the state recognized that what we were doing with the madrasas was every bit as strategic as anything else that was taking place on or off the battlefield. You know, and it just took an awfully long time for them to come to that awareness. But what I'd like to do now is just stop and take your questions, because I think that I don't learn anything listening to me talk, but I also think that it's much more likely to resonate with you if you can get some of your questions off your mind. So anybody have a question?
Yeah, if anyone has a question, just state your name and a little bit about yourself and speak directly to the microphone. So
hi, my name is Victor Nardo. I'm a religious studies student here at the U. Wandering by, I heard you speaking. Fascinating. So I'm glad I got to hear you speak.
Thank you.
You mentioned two things that stick with me. You got the Christians to engage by making an appeal to them in such a way that they seem to recognize and respond to this sense of community. And also the appeal that you were making to the Muslims was one based in the Quran, that there's a need to be generous with, you know, lesser classes of citizens or something to this effect. It seems like we're very good in the U.S. at developing people who are good with skill sets at negotiating, but in terms of approaching these irrational aspects, do you think it sounds to me like you're the right guy in the right place at the right time. How do we, can we produce people like this at an institutional level who have that recognition of the irrational? You know, can we reproduce that, or is it just a matter that the skill set is more art than science, or found and not made, or, because mm-hmm. It seems like it's very effective, but then how do you get that to where we can do more of that effectively?
Yeah, it's a very insightful question, and it's the first time I've ever actually had it. What we've been doing is we established, oh, by the way, I should mention to you that on the back table there are some brochures about our center. There's also like a project sheet that describes all the projects we're doing and what have you, and a sign-up sheet if you wanted to get on our email newsletter list. They come out once a month. They're mercifully brief, but it captures the exciting aspects of our work, and they're free. So no downside. But to your question, we had formed a partnership some time ago with Pepperdine University down in Malibu, and there are courses being taught in faith-based diplomacy there as a result of our work and trying to develop a cadre of future faith-based diplomats, if you will. But more broadly, I always welcome the opportunities to speak at universities, because it's really your generation that is able to take such ideas and run with them. You know, teaching old dogs like me new tricks is too hard. I have a number of colleagues who still don't get it. But I've been very, very encouraged by how many young folks, when we, you know, we have about 5 or 6 intern slots at our place, and there's always intense competition for those, and there's just been a lot of interest and enthusiasm. And at one point, more in a kind of a institutional way, at one point, the Henry Luce Foundation, the chairman of their board, their president, a vice president, and another member of their board came down to meet with me. This is some years ago now, probably, I would guess, 10 years ago. And I knew they were coming in advance, and I knew what they wanted. The question they were asking was, should they get in the business of funding religion and foreign policy programs? And so I had time to canvass the few people who had served as research assistants or interns at that point in time, and gave them 11 recommendations. and they enacted 10 of them. And, of course, the one they didn't enact was the one of funding efforts like ours. But what they did do is they set about giving out grants to universities, and they were very strategic about it. And I went and spoke at a number of these universities because they were getting into it. But they would establish a program in religion and foreign policy. And like the University of Southern California, it's got the highest IR population, international relations population, student body in the country, 800. So there's one there. They went up Syracuse University, which is a big focus on media, you know, Harvard University and the center that I used to be a part of, the Center for Strategic International Studies. That's for getting into policymakers. So they did a number of these, I think somewhere around 10, and lots of folks are going through those programs now, and they're sort of understanding a bit of, certainly intellectually, but I think you really have to get out there and get a hands-on feel for the situation. One thing I mentioned to you was when I recited from the Quran. Well, later on, my project director told me that each place where I did that, he says there was an audible sigh of relief in the room. It was as though the rage was defused because that was seen as a gesture of respect. Okay? A lot of people are very big on this word tolerance, and I use it myself all the time. But it's got to be more than tolerance means you're willing to put up with somebody. Respect means you care enough about them to try to understand what's of value to them, you know. And so when we're using their words from their holy book, let's open the competition in good works. It's pretty tough for them to say no to, you know. But it was defused just because of the respect, and I can't say enough about how important that is. You know. Other questions?
My name's Julie Clark. I'm with the University of Utah. I'm actually just about to graduate. You were mentioning respect and how, you know, showing that you care enough about the people you're talking to, you know, like you said, quote the Quran and things like that. So what do you think that they thought of you? Was it really important to them that you had some kind of religious background? Do you know what I mean? Or is that really big to, I guess this issue in general is that there's a divide between religious and non-religious people, even if you're a different religion versus, you know, someone that doesn't necessarily label themselves as anything. But was that, did after you were quoting from their holy book, did they then see you as maybe a religious person? And do you think that had something to do with it?
No, it's an excellent question, and it happens to be the case that the fact that I am a Christian and reasonably strong in my beliefs resonates with them. I have less difficulty interacting with Sunni Muslims than Shia Muslims do. You know, it's sort of we're so disdainful of our own who seemingly strayed from the true path. But the one thing they don't like is they probably would not open up to somebody who they deem to have no religion at all. They give favor to people of the book, which means the Jewish and Christians, over other non-monotheistic religions like Hinduism and Buddhism. And one thing about Hinduism and Buddhism that they would have great problems with is really rubs them very much the wrong way if you're out saying, well, you know, all religions are good and they all point toward the same path and we're all going on the same journey. They don't buy into that at all. The fact that I happen to be on a Christian path and it's a journey, they don't have to rationalize that. But if you have a strong monotheistic faith, counts a great deal, and it counts a lot more than if you have no faith at all, or if it's if it is a non-monotheistic faith. So it's kind of complicated, but you have to earn the right to be heard. And I'll just cite an example. The French, the authors of secularism, whenever French troops got bogged down in the war for independence in Algeria and their troops were in a tight situation and the Muslim insurgents were holding the upper hand or giving them problems, it was their military chaplains that they sent out to negotiate with the Muslims, because even they understood, you know, the need to understand and deal with religion, whether they believed in it or not. You know. And another thing, this is just a takeaway for you. It's a bit of a digression. But one thing you find is that when a Westerner says secular, a Muslim will generally hear godless, when in fact over here in the States, we really intend it to mean freedom to worship as you please. In Europe, it is much closer to the godless interpretation. And the reason for that is because the American Revolution preceded the French Revolution. You know, when our forefathers came over from England, England had made the transition from an absolute to a constitutional monarchy with religion still intact. So when our fathers came over here, and it's the American experiment, they leaned heavily on religion. But a few years later, 1789, the French Revolution, there the church was seen to be complicit with the monarchy in oppressing the people. So they took more or less of a, not an Edmund Burke approach, but a Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you know, baby out with the bathwater. They purged religion to make way for secular humanism. And that's kind of, you'll hear lots of people giving the opinion that Europe is a spiritual wasteland. You know, that's an exaggeration, because there are a lot of people in Europe who are believers besides the Muslim immigrants. But it's very interesting, the shades of definition that you get. Yes, Laura.
I'm Laura Dupuis, and I'd like to get your thoughts about the U.S. foreign policy situation, and perhaps cite examples where this reluctance to include religion into dialogue and negotiations has resulted in foreign policy failures, and what you might consider as a blueprint forward for our foreign service, military, and other entities in terms of this U.S. foreign policy dialogue.
Do you have 2 hours? Well, foreign policy has suffered for a long time by not taking into account these other religious worldviews and understanding how they work. And a good example of where that has cost us success was in Iraq. Jerry Brenner came out with the game plan, but was not informed by any interaction with Ayatollah Sistani, who was the religious spiritual leader in Iraq, and it was dead on arrival, you know. And I think it's part of why we went into Iraq thinking that, you know, we would be treated as liberators, and, you know, one person, one vote, that's what they cared about. Wasn't what they cared about. What they cared about was being able to practice their religion and to not be interfered with. For example, because Najaf, which was the spiritual capital of Shiism, was off limits under Saddam Hussein, Iranians couldn't go there. So in Iran, Qom, Q-O-M, became sort of the surrogate spiritual capital. You know, but these things kind of don't get realized. And you know, even as far back as Vietnam, we didn't have a clue about the dynamics that were taking place with the Catholic minority and the Buddhist majority until Buddhist monks started setting themselves on fire. And then we started waking up to the fact, you know. So we just have been so uninformed on so many fronts. Cost us in Iran. We were totally clueless when Ayatollah Khomeini took over. It was a huge shock to us, you know. And people wanted to report on what was going on, but the system wouldn't let them. They would be looked down upon if they mentioned religion, if you will. So we've been so dismissive of religion. And I will say this, too. It's kind of interesting. You talk about double standards. We have a double standard in our own government, and that is the fact that when the military is out there and they see a need, you know, they'll go ahead and repair the mosque if it's going to give them good community relations with where they're trying to achieve their mission. But if USAID tries to do it, the lawyers shut them down right away, separation of church and state. And an exception to the rule that I mentioned earlier about military and political leaders being inhibited from taking action, one exception was General David Petraeus. He fully understood that if you have a national security dimension and a secular purpose, there was all sorts of room to run. And when he would brief the Congress, very, very, very straightforward on his briefing charts, engage religious leaders, you know, but that he was very much the exception to the rule. So one thing in terms of what ought to be done, there are two things, and that's kind of what this book is all about, but two that I would just cite right here. One is address these political ambiguities of separation of church and state by, it could be reasonably straightforward, the president could task his Justice Department with developing the policy brief on why religious engagement should be a component of U.S. foreign policy, and then get high-level bipartisan endorsement on Capitol Hill. And then you could free up the creative energies of all these people who are somewhat intimidated. And secondly, I think it's very important at some point to establish a new position in the Foreign Service called Religion Attaché, where we would put those in embassies and U.S. embassies in those countries where religion has particular salience, like Israel or Saudi Arabia or you name it. And we looked hard at our global span of interests, and a cadre of just 30 of these folks could enable us to have people at the embassy. You take this person, you know, a lot of the naysayers who don't like the idea will say, well, that's the fastest way to get it marginalized. Well, it's already marginalized into into nothing right now. But if you treated these people, put them in the political section of the embassy staff, just like political military officers are, with the same kind of responsibilities, all of a sudden the embassy would now have the ability to assess some of these complex religious issues that float up and that get pushed aside by more pressing business, you know. So I really feel we need that kind of person. It could be either a career path in the Foreign Service, or they could be contracted, you know, but people who understand how faith drives action and what, you know, how to deal with these tough issues. So those, in a nutshell, since you don't have 2 hours, that's what I do. Yeah, thanks. Yes, sir. One more, okay.
My name is David Blatter. I'm an economics major at the U, so I'm coming from more of that perspective, but so you talked a lot about faith-based diplomacy and foreign policy, but I was thinking a lot about our social sciences here in the West, in the U.S. The way I view them, they're trying to study and understand society so we can potentially improve society. So it kind of has like a moral aspect to it. But yet at the same time, when we actually come down to studying and developing theories, we seem to completely ignore religion and even sometimes morality. Like in economics, we develop policies purely based on our base needs. When people want wealth, they want security. And we ignore the ability of morality, religion to impact society. So what is your opinion on this? And is there any way that we can possibly improve the social sciences to include religion or even morality in our look at humans?
That's a great question. And again, the first time I've heard it, I believe what you said is absolutely right, and why that is so incongruous and so misses the mark is that 84% of the world's population, religion gives them their purpose for being, you know? This gets right to the soul, you know? And yet we like to go on our merry way just pretending it doesn't exist, which is so foolhardy. It's tough to address the problem you're talking about, because one of the things that's sort of happening before our eyes is that our freedom of religion is morphing into freedom from religion, as though every atheist has a God-given right to live in a religious-free atmosphere. You know? And that's not what it's about. When you go back and look at what was intended in establishing our country, and as de Tocqueville commented in the early 1800s, there, you know, the religion is the glue that binds in this country. And when you you start losing that glue, for the most part, it's been the Judeo-Christian ethic. But you know, whatever it is, it gets to the morality and higher purpose and what have you. When you lose that, you know, human nature will fill the vacuum, and oftentimes human nature is not as well intended as we would hope it would be. I don't have a real good answer to the question, but I think you point out a real need, real need.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Johnston for an excellent and informative forum.